You know, we're a unique group in a way. We're not ultimately all unique. I mean, but we're different from a lot of believing groups out there in the world who look at the Bible. Most people who call themselves Christian, for them, the culture of the first century Jewish people is something that is of little concern. They don't really look into it. It doesn't seem to be important to them. And so they don't give it much thought. I mean, after all, Yeshua came. And when Yeshua came, that basically switched God's focus from plan A, which was the Israelites, now to plan B, which is spiritual Israel or the church. At least that's what a lot of people believe. And so if they were to continue with that belief and that there is really, you know, there's something new going on now and what was old is old and gone, there's really no need to look back at the example of what happened years and years before Messiah came along. But for us, there's a little bit of difference because we realize that in many respects, nothing changed when Messiah came. Messiah fulfilled his role and he didn't change things. He continued on with what was before. But of course, his death paved the way so that we could all be a part of his salvation. And so for us, there's a need for us, if we want to take and convey this thought and be able to teach this thought, that God is continuing on with plan A, that there never was ever a plan B, then it would be to our advantage to learn a few things about this period of time that happened that led up to the coming of the Messiah. You know, Messiah came at a very specific time in history. It wasn't happenstance. It was the way God intended for things to be. And so it's important for us to be able to explain those things. What I'm talking about is that period of time, they call it the intertestamental period of time. It's the time between basically the Babylonian captivity and the time of the birth of John the Baptist. During that period of time, there's not much written and very little history, but yet there were some very monumental things took place during that time that helped fashion first century Judaism, the Judaism in which Yeshua was born. One of the things that happened during this intertestamental period was the rise of the synagogue. And we can see those words in the New Testament, and we can understand it, but we really think that that's something in the past. Well, this message is not about the synagogue, but instead, it's about a very specific group of people that helped fashion and form the synagogue and many other things in first century Judaism. This is this group of people is called the Men of the Great Assembly. Now, how many of you ever heard of the Men of the Great Assembly? Oh, nobody has. All right, Don. He's back there. He's going to save me then. All right, so there is this group of people, and they were called the Men of the Great Assembly. We're going to talk about this as an introduction to a couple of teachings on the synagogue system so that we can get a little bit better grasp of what that is all about. Back about 450 years ago, shortly after the Babylonian captivity, there was a man named Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel began to bring, he was told by God, obviously, through whatever means God conveyed this to him, he moved him to take and lead a contingent of Jewish people back to the land of Israel. Of course, they had been cast out for a number of years. And so they came back and they began the rebuilding of the temple. Well, about 60 years after that, there was a second wave of people came back to Jerusalem. And these people's responsibility was to basically to build the walls of the city of Jerusalem. So they were basically going to build the walls that would make the temple intact. There was a difference, though, in the way of thinking between these two groups. This first group of people came back, and they were excited about building the temple. Of course, they were excited about getting out of Babylon as well. And so they came back and they did their work, and obviously there were problems there. But the second group of people, when they came back, one of the things they left behind, one of the things they left in Babylon, was their Hebrewness. They were Jews, but they didn't act like Jews. They didn't act like Hebrews. they came back and they started mixing with the people of the land. And we know all those stories about how they married pagan wives and all of this. So they, when they came out of Babylon, they did much the same as the northern tribes of Israel had done. They had basically left God behind. They had left the Torah behind and turned their back on God. Now, there's a number of theories thrown out there as to why they did that. One was that they didn't have a king. You know, for the last previous, 500-600 years, Israel had a king, and the Jewish people had a king. And so they had this king figure that they could take and rally around, sort of, and that sort of kept them together. But they didn't have the king. Not only that, they didn't have the temple. And without the temple, or at least the temple as they had known it, they didn't have the sacrifices, they didn't have the festivals in such a way as they had had them before. They didn't have these things that would draw them together as a community of people. And so they got back to Babylon. I mean, got back to Israel, to the land, and they began to act like the people of the land, marry into the people of the land. And if they had continued much longer, then the Jewish culture would have basically disintegrated, because there's the Jews that were left in Babylon. They weren't actually acting like Jews, and there was Jews down in Egypt, and they weren't necessarily acting like Jews either. So it was quite possible that the entire Jewish culture could have died. So to remedy that situation, God sent Ezra and Nehemiah down to the land. And Ezra understood what the people needed. They needed to take and learn about the Torah again and learn how to apply it in their lives. And so when Ezra came back, his what he said that he wanted to do and what he did was that he says he had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. And I want to focus on the teaching. Ezra's role and responsibility was to teach the statutes and ordinances to the people of Israel. So how is he going to do that? How is he going to be able to teach this to the people of Israel? Well, the vehicle that he used in order to take and do that was called the Ashne Knesset HaGadolah, or it basically means the men of the great assembly. Now, we've heard the word Knesset before. What's the Knesset? Anybody know? The Israeli Parliament. The Israeli Parliament is the Knesset. And the Knesset is simply the assembly of the people. That's what Knesset means. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the study of the synagogue itself. But he created what is called the Knesset, or the men of the great assembly. It's hard for me to say it in Hebrew. And their sole purpose was to restore what it meant to be a Jew. The Knesset was 120 members, had 120 members. Those 120 members were made up of the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and assuming there's a number of other prophets as well. Notable men such as Mordecai, the hero of the Esther story, Zerubbabel, the man who led the first contingent back, and then, of course, Nehemiah. And then Ezra himself was the Nasi of this group of 120 men. The Nasi is a word that means the leader. It comes from the Hebrew word Nasa, which means to lift up. So he was the Nasi, the president of the synagogue. We had a Nasi of the synagogue in the first century. His name was James. And so this is the sort of the connection you have here. He's the one who was the president or the leader of the synagogue, or he was the leader of the men of the great assembly. Now, where did Ezra? Ezra is the one who's credited with creating this body of men. They call the men of the great assembly. Where did he get the authority to do that? Well, it's likely he got it from the Torah itself, where in Numbers 11 it says, "So the Lord said to Moshe, 'Gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them to the tabernacle of meeting, that they may stand there with you. Then I will come down and talk with you there, and I will take the Spirit that is upon you, and will put that same Spirit upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you may not bear it yourself alone. So this is probably the... If Ezra felt like he had to have authority to do this, this is where he probably got his authority from, this particular Torah enactment. So again, the goal of this was to take and restore observance to the land and turn the people once again to the temple. So he wanted to restore what it meant to be a Hebrew, what it meant to be Jewish. And that's all tied up in the Torah and in the temple. So he began to do this by enacting laws. And we see those, some of those in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah both. He began to enact laws, and those laws were designed to bring conformity to the observance of the Torah commandments. Talked about that a little bit at the end of the Torah portion today, that we had to have a conformity in the calendar for the Passover to actually work the way God intended for it to be. Well, they saw that they needed conformity. Before they were taken into Babylon, the conformity was in the set practices at the temple. But they didn't have that anymore, so they needed conformity. So what they wanted to do is just focus in on the Torah and focus in on the temple. And so Ezra made a few laws out there to sort of help bring that about. One of those was this one right here. Okay, he says, also we made ordinances for ourselves to exact from ourselves yearly 1/3 of a shekel for the service of the house of God. So this was an enactment by Ezra to help bring an appreciation for the tabernacle, or for the temple. And this was what we would call the temple tax. Now, if you'll, those of us remember, you know, studying the temple tax was actually a half shekel, right? Well, this is a third shekel tax. So Ezra deviated a little bit from what we believe to be the temple tax when he gave this commandment. Now, another example of this, another example is in this one right here. It says, so it was at the gates of... There was a hassle there. There was a problem there with the Sabbath. They weren't keeping the Sabbath. And there was people coming in and selling things on the Sabbath. And so Nehemiah says, so it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. So the way that Ezra felt like he could take and sort of help the people to get more in touch with the Sabbath was that he prohibited burdens from being brought in on the Sabbath day. If there's nothing to buy, not much commerce, right? Okay, so this is what he enacted. Both of these, by the way, are things that are not necessarily in Torah. Now, there's allusions to them in Torah, but these enactments are not in Torah. You might call these halakhic decisions. These are decisions that were made by Ezra, and by the way, most of these decisions were probably made by the men of the Great Assembly. Though we see them being credited to Ezra in the book of Nehemiah, they were more than likely decisions made by the men of the Great Assembly, and Ezra, being the Nasi, was the one who was responsible for enacting these things. But they were probably, at least in these two cases, they were practically or probably halakhic decisions, or what we might call oral traditions. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Now, there's very little given in the Torah about the men of the Great Assembly. Or in our Bibles, there's very little given about the men of the Great Assembly. In fact, it's never mentioned by name. But it is written about oftentimes in the Jewish writings, specifically in the Talmud. In the Talmud, though, in the writings that are there, it talks about how these men were responsible for making and creating these various institutions within Judaism that did help get the people back in tune with the Torah and with the walk of God. Some of the things that are credited to the men of the Great Assembly, we'll talk about here in just a minute. One of those, there's a number of things actually. One of those was the canonization of the Bible. At the time of the Babylonian captivity, there was a lot of manuscripts of the Torah. There is various manuscripts of the prophets. Some of the prophets, like Jeremiah, wrote over a period of years, and so these were all had to be collected and all of that. There is no one book. I mean, Jeremiah didn't sit down and write the entire book of Jeremiah in one sitting. These are all things that were spread out over time. So the men of the Great Assembly are credited with taking all of these various manuscripts and compiling them together. There's also manuscripts that were not used in the Bible. The Jews had all kinds of writings. I mean, they were in Babylon. What did they have time to do? They sit around and write. So, no, I'm just kidding. But they had a lot of, there's a lot of Jewish, there are a lot of manuscripts out there that are never included in that never made it into the canon, that were out there and available at the time. It was the role of the men of the Great Assembly to gather these together. So what they had to do, they had to determine the criteria for inclusion in the canon. First thing they had to do is come up with authenticity. Was it an authentic writing? Well, I'm going to throw this out. I'm not saying this is true or not, but I would suspect that probably the Book of Enoch may have been one of those books. The Book of Enoch was written by someone who claimed to be Enoch, but the authenticity of that, or the possibility of that, was probably nil, that it was actually written by Enoch. So that's one example. There again, it may not. I don't even know when the Book of Enoch was written, but they did not include that. If it was then, if they had it available to them then, it was not included in the canon, right? Because it's not in ours, right? Okay, so it was not included. So they had to determine the authenticity of it. One of the ways they did that is determine if it had ever been, if it was written by a known prophet, or if it had been referred to by a known prophet. So if a prophet had referred to a book, then it would have been included. In the Book of Chronicles, we hear about, it makes reference to a book of the wars of the Jews. Now, this was not the one that was written by Josephus, but it was a book that was available, but probably was not included in the canon for whatever reason. We don't know. Then they had to gather and compile the writings of the individual prophets. And again, they had to gather all the manuscripts from these prophets. They had to combine them in books, but then they had to make a determination if this prophecy or if this prophet was really a prophet or not. And one of the things that they did was to try to determine if the prophecy that was written was a prophecy valid for all time. That's why we often see prophecies that we call them dual prophecies, that they know that they happened once, but they saw how they could be a part of a prophecy for later down in history. And that's why when we see many of the minor prophets, we'll see in those prophecies about Israel that in a way were being played out in that day, but could not have been fulfilled until the end of times. And so that's one of the things that they would do to qualify books. Another thing was that they had to qualify books written outside the land. You know, if a book was written outside the land, then it couldn't have been much of a book. But there was three books in the Bible that were written outside the land. One of those was the book of Daniel. Another was the book of Ezekiel. And then, of course, then there's the book of Esther. And Esther had a hard time getting that book into the canon, because in the book of Esther, the name God, or the title God, is never used. And so they wondered if, well, should this book be included in the canon? Well, just so happened to be that Mordecai was on the Men of the Great Assembly, one of the Men of the Great Assembly, so it probably helped get that book in there. Plus, it was a good prophetic book and taught a lot of good lessons. And then they had to ask if the current day prophets should have their books included in the Men of the Great Assembly, or in the canon. And one, or three of those books was the book of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, all three of those guys were part of the men of the Great Assembly. So they had to ask themselves, should we include these guys in the canon as well? And obviously they did. And then what they did is they divided the canon into three parts. They divided it into what's called the Torah. We're familiar with that. The Nevi'im, or the prophets, and the Ketuvim, which is the writings. That's the Psalms, the book of Job, Song of Solomon, those types of books were the writings. They take the words Torah, the first letters Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, you have an acronym that says Tanakh, and that's why the Jews now call their Bible is called the Tanakh, because it's comprised of these three portions of Scripture. Now, did the Jews make a good decision? Did the men of the Great Assembly make good decisions when they chose the books that they put in? Were they valid? Did they get any acknowledgement anywhere along the way? Well, they did, and they got this acknowledgement by a man whose name was Yeshua. Because in Luke 24, Yeshua says, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled, which are written in the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim." The Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, or the writings. So Yeshua put his stamp of approval on what the men of the Great Assembly did. Now, this is in fact a validation for us that the men of the Great Assembly actually did exist. Because why would the Jewish people ever take and come up with this concept of the men of the Great Assembly and give them credit for writing these and compiling these books together and making that the Hebrew Bible, and then Yeshua coming along acknowledging, yeah, they did a good job? Well, see, this sort of helps us to see that Yeshua did put his stamp of approval on it, but also that the men of the Great Assembly actually was in existence. All right, so another thing that the men of the Great Assembly were credited with, and that is formalized prayer. Now, they believe the prayers probably began back in Babylon, that the Jewish people, you know, the word Yehuda means what? Praise. Okay, praise. All right, so they are the ones who were given the responsibility of praising God. And so during their time in Babylon, they wrote a number of psalms and songs, and there was probably various versions of these songs. Well, it was the intent of the men of the Great Assembly to take and standardize the worship in many ways so that the people, no matter where they were in the land, were all worshiping the same. It's sort of like us. You know, today we're studying a parasha that millions of people around the world are studying on the same day. There's sort of a standardization to that. And so when God's looking down from His throne in heaven, He'll see people all over the world studying His Word and studying the same words at the same time. And so these are sort of the things that the men of the Great Assembly wanted to do. So they took the prayers, and it's understood that they took and sort of put them in a specific order, and then they edited them. Now what this did is, again, this created a way where the people could come together in unison and do things in unison, something they were unable to do in Babylon. Because in Babylon, they didn't. The unity of the Jewish people before Babylon again was the sacrifices in the temple. Without either of those, the people were lost out there. So this was a way for the people to take all of their various songs, put them together, and sing together. Sort of like we did the other night, New Moon. You know, we all sang together in unity, right? And so if we all took and had our own versions of those songs and tried to sing all those songs in different versions, wouldn't have sounded real good together, right? So it was good to bring everything together. They also began to create traditions, like Kiddush and Havdalah. These are Jewish traditions, the opening of the Shabbat, the ending of the Shabbat. And it's understood that these things began possibly in Babylon, but they were sort of codified and made uniform by the men of the Great Assembly in Israel. Then there's the universal prayer service, which is the highlight of the highlight of Jewish liturgy is a prayer called the Shemoneh Esrei. The Shemoneh Esrei means the 18 benedictions, which today there are 19 of them. It's sometimes called the Amidah, which means the standing prayers, because it's said standing up. Well, the men of the Great Assembly are the ones who are credited with compiling the Amidah prayer, putting it all in the same order, to where when the Jewish people all prayed together, they were praying the same prayer at the same time in the same order. So this is one of the advantages or one of the benefits that they brought to the people. Again, this was all designed to bring the people together. One of the theories as to why they believe that they should take and formalize the prayers is this verse in the book of Hosea. It says, this is of course speaking of the northern tribes, but nevertheless it would apply to them as well. Take words with you, basically means take Devarim with you, or take the book of Deuteronomy with you, and return to Yahweh. Say to him, take away our iniquity, receive us graciously, for we will offer the sacrifice of our lips. So they would look at the sacrifice of our lips, the prayers and the praise that we take and give to God as sacrifices. And so this is one of their reasons for doing this. Now, when they get so therefore, when they got back to the land, or when they were in the land, when the men of the Great Assembly did this, those people who lived in Jerusalem then, they would be taking and doing their worship at the temple as part of the sacrificial system. But the people who lived outside of Jerusalem, instead of them, because they didn't before, but instead of them, like they would this long trip, make the trip up to they together in their lease, they would take the same sacrifices, they would these prayer of them sacrifice, being a, of the service of Jerusalem, a part of it, you might saying these, knowing that you were in Tiv, or if you're Galilee, or if you're Eric, you're all saying the same time. So this would unity to the Jewish day. It wasn't as temple itself, it was a to seem to work. Another credited way to sin is creation of an education. Now, hold again. He says, my destroyed knowledge, be rejected, I will offer you from before, because you in the law of God also children. So, based on this, I saw begin to the people. It not become created, and then the same happened as had the northern cast off. Well, if the prophet Malachi prophecy aimed at much, remember, east. The Kai were east. The response of the priest, the sacrifice was the other. The law and the prayer on butts. Felt like, though he, the priest, felt there for he done the way that it pinned the priest so. So he did. He began to create or revise the synagogue. Now this became a prayership of but made the standard of Torah report. So they began to learn, they would begin the Torah. But these also be center of life for the Jews. They are just they would the week they would do hence. In fact, where you begin acknowledgement ages. This ages start appear people who be eligible. They came out of the synagogue. So education was very important. And this was the credit the of you know, this. Now there's some other they worked as well. Is these calendar we used to calendar seems apparent during the captive people to some of the Babylon and they figured out that the moon around the earth. The fracking that period. But they create calendar-based lunars, but they realize follow a lunar what you get your seasons. They counted the year time and also the 18 months and 7 did this all. One of the greatest ones who are credited with creating that cycle. They're also credited, though, with the understanding that you had to check these things by the sighting of the moon as well. And so, from what I understand, they also initiated the sightings at that time as well in order to standardize or to qualify, you might say, their calculations. So, let me see. What the standardized calendar did for the Jewish people at that time is it made the it gave them the ability to observe all of the festivals together as a people. Because there again, if you are up in the Galilee and they were down in Jerusalem, it's what, 70 to 100 miles difference there. People can't run that fast to say that, you know, it's now the new moon. Internet was not quite in existence at that time. And so they standardized it through the use of a calendar, and that standardized the worship. In fact, the calendar is credited with keeping the Jewish people together even today. You know, it's interesting. One of the things I was studying to come up with this, it says that when the czars came down upon the Jews back in the early 1800s, you know what the first thing they took from them was? The calendar. Didn't even try to keep them from doing the Torah. They said if we just take their calendar from them, they'll all get out of sync and the whole system will fall apart. So that's the same thing that Antiochus did. Antiochus did too. He took their calendars, their new moon celebrations, away from them. So anyway, this is part of the. These are a couple of the things that they're credited with doing. So with focus on the synagogue and the temple, and one other thing, they were credited with the observance of Purim. Now, we can say, okay, no, Purim was already figured. We can look in the book of Esther, and we see that Mordecai had already determined Purim was. Well, the thing that they want us to understand is that the book of Esther was probably written during the time of the men of the great assembly. And so when Mordecai, being a part of the men of the great assembly, they made a decision when to observe Purim, and so that was interjected into the book of Esther that was probably written during that period of time. Remember, Esther was written during the Persian captivity. That's when the Persians had taken over and had thrown out Nebuchadnezzar. And so the Persian Empire in the time of Esther, that period of time probably was only 50 to 60 years prior to the time of the men of the Great Assembly. So, once we get the timeline down, we can sort of see these things. All right, so the men of the Great Assembly were credited with a number of things, but one of the things they were not credited with, and that is creating the foundations of Rabbinic Judaism. But I would submit that they, even though it was not their desire to do that or their purpose in creating the foundations of Rabbinic Judaism, I would submit that that's indeed what they did. With their focus on the synagogue as well as the temple, what they eventually did was they shifted the people from relying totally on the temple for their worship and for their sense of being. They sort of shifted it off in some ways to the synagogue. And in doing so, the people now became somewhat not as dependent, you might say, on the temple and their services and the worship services at the temple in order to keep them together as a people. And so it sort of moved off that way. And in so doing, and with the creation of some of these enactments that they gave in order to try to bring the people together, and some of them seemingly to being halakhic in sense and in purpose, it's interesting that the slogan that is sort of credited to as the sort of the main slogan of the men of the Great Assembly is this right here, and that is that they are to be deliberate in judgment, raise many students, and build a fence around the Torah. And this is found in Pirkei Avot 1. It's the very first passage in Pirkei Avot. This is of the Talmud. They are to be deliberate in judgment, raise many students, and build a fence around the Torah. And this is precisely what they did. This is precisely what they did. Though the Pharisees didn't come on the scene for nearly 300 years, I believe the Pharisees derived their inspiration from the sort of the mandate of the men of the Great Assembly. Because the Pharisees had all these, they created all these traditions as well, didn't they? Well, one of the traditions that the Pharisees created was, again, the temple tax, which I believe was sort of sort of morphed out of the enactment given by Ezra back early. Remember the enactment he gave? He said that they would have one-third of a shekel tax for the temple. And the reason I believe this is this. If we go to Matthew chapter 17, verse 24, we see Yeshua doing a very interesting thing here. And I'll just read the story here. Here's Yeshua and Peter. And when they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" Now, where were they? Were they in Jerusalem? No, they were in Capernaum. They were 100 miles away, on the north side of the Galilee. Okay? And here they are taking up a tax up there on the north side of the Galilee. And Yeshua says, he said, "Yes," and when he had come into the house, Yeshua anticipated him, saying, "What do you think, Simon?" All right, so here's Yeshua when they were asking him about the temple tax. Does your teacher take the temple tax? Well, they came to Peter, okay? And Peter says, "Yes, we pay the temple tax." And so Yeshua says, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from the strangers?" And Peter said to him, "From strangers." And Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you shall find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and for you." All right, so Yeshua is saying, in regards to this temple tax, this is halakhic in nature, is basically he's saying. This is halakha. And this was, he's probably implying that this is old halakha. This is halakha that's 300 years old, that the Pharisees have reenacted or have brought back into Israel. Of course, the Pharisees, when they brought it in, they made it a half shekel temple tax. Now, there is a tax that's mandated by the Torah, and that's the tax that you pay not once a year, but once a lifetime. It's the redemption money that you pay. And so the Pharisees had taken that and they had combined this with the half or the third shekel tax of Ezra, which Ezra had no Torah authority to do, but he enacted it as halakha, and they made these and they sort of combined it together. And what Yeshua says, let's pay it so that we don't offend these people. And so he went along with the halakha, even though it wasn't, in his mind, something that was mandated, something that was required of him. So what I'm getting at here is that, in a way, he supported the building of fences around the Torah, which was the mandate given to the men of the Great Assembly. Be deliberate in judgment, raise many students, and build a fence around the Torah. So, you know, an example of a fence for us is that we don't want to spill coffee on the carpet, so let's don't allow the kids to carry coffee around. Okay? That would be a fence in such a way, in many instances. All right, so, going on. The men of the Great Assembly, this was a rather short-lived institution. It's estimated that it was only in existence from 410 B.C. to 312 B.C., just a little over 100 years. According to tradition, when the members died off, they were never replaced. And so, as people continued to die away, they never did reinstate, or they never had anybody come in there and take their place. Obviously, it had done its job. It had served the purpose for which it was formulated, and so there was no need to keep it going. So, with such a short duration, with a short life, the men of the Great Assembly, just a very small portion of Jewish history. They share just a brief moment in the entire timeline of Jewish history. But nevertheless, I believe they made a tremendous impact on Judaism, especially the Judaism of the first century. Their focus on the dissemination of Torah knowledge to the people set the stage for the birth of what later became Pharisaic Judaism. And the Pharisaic Judaism is the system that Yeshua used in order to take and raise up disciples and to send his disciples off. Because Rabbinic Judaism is what created this rabbi-disciple pattern. And Rabbinic Judaism focused on the use of the synagogue, whereas the Sadducees focused on the use of the temple. And so, getting people to the synagogue, getting them in the synagogue, created the audience for the rabbis, but it also created the audience for Yeshua and his disciples. Like the Maccabean revolt of about 250-300 BC, and the effect it had on keeping the Jewish people from assimilating into the Greek culture, the men of the Great Assembly helped rebuild the Jewish culture after the Babylonian captivity, and it played a big part in preparing for the coming of the King of the Jews, Messiah Yeshua.